I'm Sasha Mayer, entrepreneur, mother, and co-founder of Mamava, the inventor of the freestanding lactation pod. My newest baby, The Bodacious Optimist, a podcast dedicated to celebrating and learning from the people who have inspired and helped me in my entrepreneurial journey. They are designers and storytellers, business leaders and activists who have challenged the status quo and thrived. Bodacious optimists believe that there are always solutions waiting to be unveiled. Hi, it's Sasha Mayer, and I'm here with my co-producer, Nikki Mikko. Nick, who are we talking to today?
We are talking to Michael Jagger, and I am really excited for this one, for folks to hear it. I've talked to Michael lots of times. I've listened to you talk to Michael, but what I got to witness in this conversation around the history of Mamava was really cool. I also really love just Michael's lens on life. It's very yogic, and lots of what he was saying resonated with me.
It's definitely a masterclass on branding. I did actually want to mention that, you know, Michael was a mentor of mine. We talk about that, and I worked for him in the studios that were called JDK Design, and then that evolved to be called Solidarity of Unbridled Labor. So just to clarify that, if people are confused when they're listening to it.
Okay, so here we are with designer, entrepreneur, and idea farmer Michael Jagger.
Today, I am really excited to be talking with Michael Jagger, co-founder of the design studio Solidarity of Unbridled Labor. For more than 30 years, Michael has been designing and collaborating with international brands like Burton Snowboards, Microsoft Xbox, and Patagonia. Mamava was created under Michael's guiding support at the design studio, where Christine Dodson, my co-founder, and I incubated the business. Michael has been a mentor to me and key advisor to Mamava. Michael, thank you so much for joining me today. I am so grateful to have this space to talk and reflect on the more than 20 years we've had of working together.
Wow. 20 years. Yeah, I hear that number more and more. How much time we've spent together.
I think it's probably 25 years. But so you're a business person and a designer and a creative director and a mentor to many people. How would you introduce yourself and your work to this audience?
Wow. I'm actually a dyslexic farmer from St. Albans, Vermont, is the reality. And somehow I've found my way to some sort of path of intention through creativity, I think, ultimately. So I don't know. I think I really embrace the very humble and... humble early learnings of growing up on a farm in a very small town in northern Vermont, I think, is something that I've always maintained. And it's created a very deep connection to nature, which actually I think it has a lot to do with business and has a lot to do with what we all kind of find ourselves doing in the world. You know, nature is a great metaphorical reference point to idea growth and nurturing, and the more that I've been able to work with amazing people like yourself, Sasha, and Christine, and others, the more I realize that's true. So I guess I'm a idea farmer.
So I think that goes with something I know about you, which is you're one of the hardest working people I've ever met. Does that come from those rural roots or this idea of farming and the kind of investment you have to make for the yield that you get at the end?
I always just had my dad had an amazing, I don't know if work ethic is the right thing. It was more just about if you're going to do something, you should do it with intention and conviction or don't do it. So it's not necessarily about working hard. I guess it really is about conviction. Like if you believe in what it is that you're doing and part of, you're not really paying attention to the clock. I don't know. I don't know that it's just about doing hard work or the labor of it. Even though Solidarity of Unbridled Labor has labor in it, the labor I specifically chose, as you remember, the European spelling of labor with hour, because it's about the the collective effort that goes into building ideas that are built on conviction.
So starting out in rural Vermont to then being the head of a super influential design studio that has worked with these global brands, how did that happen?
The farm that I grew up on is about 15 minutes from the Canadian border, so it's very, very northern Vermont. And the farm was on the side of a little mountain, and that little mountain is called Hardack, and there was a tractor engine with a rope tow, and it was the tiniest little ski area that was about 300 yards long, and it was open till 11 o'clock every night. And so there was a dimension of sports and connection to nature in that way. And because of it wasn't really understood at that point, but the dyslexia issues that I was dealing with, I wasn't a particularly good reader, or I wasn't very skilled at math. And thankfully, I managed to figure out that I could draw, or I had some kind of skill. And my wonderful mother was like, do more of that drawing thing. That might be a good idea. So I was drawing and painting and creating in that light. And I had other amazing people as well, a high school teacher named Keith Gallup, who lives in Georgia, Vermont, who's still a painter. And he as well was a great mentor to me and suggested that maybe I consider going to design school. But part of the catalyst for that as well was I was living through music. I was all about David Bowie, Alice Cooper, Patti Smith, Sex Pistols, everything that was happening in the music scene. I lived through Cream Magazine, Hit Parader, Circus, cover to cover. My room was just covered with rock and roll, punk rock imagery, and I was just listening to music constantly. And somehow I pieced together art, and album covers was the future. So the reason I ended up in design school and effectively heading toward illustration, and I was painting and doing a lot of drawing, I ended up in design school because I wanted to do album covers. So that was the idea. But at the same time, growing up on the farm, I was building bicycles and motorcycles and all kinds of equipment and gear all the time. So I had a lot of passion. At that point, snowboarding didn't exist, so I was doing skateboards and skiing and so on. But I was always working on product, like constructing things, adding graphics to product. So interestingly, that journey, once I was in design school and I started learning from international, you know, design professors, I was very fortunate to have professors from Holland and Switzerland, as well as in Canada and the U.S., but had an incredible enlightening moment about typography and in early dimensions of strategy and intention through design. And I was always sort of forcing dimension into it, like packaging, structures. It wasn't just graphic design. It was a structural design. So somehow, if you follow that thread, and then I was just kind of pit stopping in Burlington theoretically for a year, and now 50 years have gone by and a lot of different things. But I was kind of pit stopping here, and then had the opportunity to connect with a lot of bands, was doing a lot of work with IBM, actually, through the General Technologies Division, a number of projects there. The ski industry, which was heavily a part of what was happening in Vermont, I started working with Elan and Gaetze, and suddenly was traveling around the world on design projects and working in the ski industry when snowboarding was born. And I had inklings of it, and I had a snurfer, and I was kind of on somewhat of the path that Jake was on. But the convergence in all this, as far as the story, was that, you know, when I saw snowboards, and having grown up a skateboarder and the album cover idea, snowboards were album covers. They were this canvas just ready to be cultural communication and art. So that gives you an idea of kind of what the journey was, and then how do you end up in a relationship to product and design and brand and ideas. And that's what everything was really the foundational thing that built what was JDK, was a multidiscipline design entity. And uniquely, we were not just a graphic design practice. We were not only, you know, we were doing industrial design, we were doing online video, graphics, illustration, writing, communication, advertising. So we had built over 20 years or so, we built a vertical construct that could do all those things, which this will all come around to. How does this relate to Mamava? We got to a point, you know, and I was fortunate to be able to have many, many incredibly talented people with all kinds of different disciplines and a lot of misfits that we magnetically pulled into our orbit from all over the world. I mean, we had people coming from everywhere to work with us. And thankfully, one of them was Sasha and Christine. But because we had built this vertical construct, the idea was we can create brands. And Mamava was one of those experiments. But it gives you an idea of like, well, how do these intersections happen? Like, why would that happen in Vermont? And why? And UVM is what brought you to Vermont.
When I came to work for the design studio in around 1995, that discipline of brand strategy was just emerging, I think, really. In marketing first and then getting into design. And as I recall, in those early days, particularly with Burton, we would go and present dozens of concepts, for example, on a creative campaign. And it was inspiring and a calorie burn and amazing, but it was strategy that actually helped us refine that process, deliver on strategy. Mm-hmm. Can you harken back to that a little bit and the philosophy that the studio applies? You have a living brand philosophy around branding that I think calls back to that nature metaphor. Can you tell us a little bit about the living brand process or the philosophy that you've applied to branding?
Yeah. Yeah, and can explain some of, like, it was a learned idea. I mean, it was something that emerged. The more we looked at it, the more we understood what we were part of. You know, it's interesting, your point about the early days of strategy, it was, you know, intuitively, I think we always knew, or I always felt like, it's not just about creating cool art. Like, there's a lot of people who fall into, you know, they get trapped by that thinking. And often with Burton as one example, people would be thinking like, oh, that's really great. You get to work on that Burton stuff and they just let you do whatever you want and you just create weird, bizarre things. That wasn't at all what was happening. This was about shaping culture. A lot of, you know, in the very early days, it was like we were the counter universe to skiing, which was the dominant force on how people related to the mountains at that time. The strategy, you know, the intent was, hey, there's another way to look at the mountains. There's another way to be on the mountains. There's this sideways orientation. That was the strategy. The intent was to show the world another way of understanding how you could create with gravity on a mountain. And what does that look like and feel? No one had ever done it before. So that's, I think it's important for people to understand strategy is intention, and then how do you express that is branding. And so there wasn't a lot of framing around the vocabulary and things, but as you remember, Sasha, I mean, we were actually very leery of people who would come to us with effectively saying, hey, make us cool like you did with these guys. It's like, no, we need to figure out what makes you different. And why you matter in the world. Why is anyone going to care about what you're doing, whether it's a product or service or whatever it might be? Then we'll think about how that's going to be expressed. And yes, the point is to create it in a different way, and you have to do that. Nobody's going to talk about or remember or share something unless there's some level of difference to it and some unique value that it brings into the world. So I think that's important to keep in mind. The other thing in terms of the living brand, and honestly, Burton was a real catalyst for it. You know, our intuition, and actually I'll go back to music again. When you look at the Beatles, when you look at the Clash, when you look at Bob Dylan, you know, and any band or artist worthy, they are learning and moving and learning and moving and learning and moving. It's a living idea. And with Burton, one of the things that was interesting, and all of those artists I really admired, and I would just like, God, what is David Bowie going to transform into now? And it wasn't just, again, he was making a cultural commentary. He wasn't just taking weird experiments. He was kind of reflecting what was happening in the world. And that's just one example. But The Clash, the same. They would learn and move, and every album was a new installation of their thinking and what they learned. And with Burton, we had the opportunity of the seasons. So every season was a moment of renewal. And it was a pretty radical thing. It wasn't just like, hey, what new ads are we going to do or something? It was totally new. The equipment had evolved radically. The boards were new. The bindings were new. The apparel, everything was new. And therefore, the communication would be new. So we looked at it as like every season was a new album. And like, and what are we going to do to help, you know, engage the audience we had and attract new people? And if you take that further, it's nature. It's cycles in nature. So we started to realize Burton's more like a living thing than some machine that's repeating a pattern. That's not at all what's going on. The culture is in a constant state of change. Therefore, the ideas and the expressions should be in a constant state of change. And that was really the birthplace of the living brand. And a lot of people continue, I think, to live in the fallacy that brands are machines, that it's about consistency and pattern and rhythm. And they're very almost militant. Even the language, the lexicon that I absolutely disdain is, you know, mission, tactics, target audience, war rooms, absolute bullshit. Like, it is the worst way to think and organize your relationship with an audience. And it should be with an audience, not what you do to or for it. Like, you should be one with your audience. And that stops you thinking in those terms like target and so on. And that's, again, the living, if you stop thinking about it like this sort of tactical machine-like way of creating ideas, that's where the living system and a living brand really comes into focus. You see it as a living thing that's just, it's almost like photosynthesis. Like when I see a beautiful brand or idea, I see it as a living thing. Like it's almost the good ones, you know, Apple is often used, but I think they have done a good job. It's almost like a photosynthesis happening, where you've got this foundational, these tenets that are sort of foundational to what they believe and what they do and the creativity that technology can facilitate. But then they're drinking in the sunlight of culture. Like, what are people feeling and needing and desiring?
Yeah, I brand strategists love Venn diagrams. So as part of that early formation of the living brand, the emotional, rational and cultural dimensions that are what the brand is. And in particular, I think a difference is that what you've described, the culture, the change, the season, and the context in which the brand or the company exists is so important that people aren't paying attention to. And it takes some level of discipline and work to be doing that. I think in terms of Mamava, that cultural context in which we first created the idea for Mamava, nobody was really talking about breastfeeding or infrastructure design or the problem that was there. And now we're in a place where we have legislation. We have the Pump Act, a world where the employee is more empowered, where breastfeeding is more understood as something that should be a right versus just a privilege for those who can stay home. So I think the cultural context is so important for companies to be paying attention to, and it can change on a dime. Pandemic changed the cultural context for so many aspects
I think
of
it,
our
not
society.
Only it can, it will. It will change. That's another assured thing when you think about the living metaphor. It's like, Whatever you're part of will change, and you will need to respond or shape and guide it. You need to love that. You need to love the fact that it will change.
So I think that's one of the things that's been really interesting and a challenge. You've been part of culture creating brands. When you started working with Burton, there are many mountains where snowboarding wasn't even allowed. And similarly with Mamava, the idea wasn't out there yet. So we had to be in a position, and you've had with many of your accounts, like New Era Cap, I would say, or Lululemon, and the yoga has been around for thousands of years. But in terms of getting it adopted by the broader culture, can you talk about that balance of pushing culture and creating culture at the same time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a guy named Alex Smith who has a new book out. Actually, it's one of the books I wanted to share with the group called No Bullshit Strategy. And he's actually a writer that works. If anybody that's looked at PipDeck, he's one of the authors of that stuff as well. But he has a term, actually, I think that's relevant to what you're talking about. It's expressed in a lot of different forms, but he talks about weirding the normal and normaling the weird. So in weirding the normal, it's like you might have a category or a space or a certain need that a group of brands or a cluster of brands may work in. And what needs to happen is someone needs to come in with a fresher perspective that's just sort of a weird counterpoint to it that can create a new breakout from that. So it sort of reframes the category. And it's really the art form of balancing that. Like, how radically odd do you get? And how recognizable are you? And the other point to that is sometimes it's normalizing the weird. It may be some sort of strange idea, and you're in the process, and then you need to help people understand that, which is kind of the Mamava case. When you showed up at the airports with Mamava, people were like, what is that odd? What is that for? Like, is it a phone booth? Is it that, you had tons of people, and also on the relationship end of like, how do you actually get it placed? Who do you talk to? Is it HR? Is it operations? You were shaping a whole new category. So that's part of the art form when you're actually doing something culture shaping. It's usually related to that. You're either bringing something weird that's going to disrupt the norm, or you've got this, you're going to bring a little bit of normal to something that's a little bit odd that people aren't quite understanding, and you're going to make it more accessible. Industrial design often does that. Products will often like just tweak. If you go too far, you'll just become such an outlier that you'll have a tiny audience. So it's managing that relation. I think that's a lot of what culture shaping is about, understanding that equilibrium.
You've been a huge mentor, not just in terms of brand and design, but as someone who has owned and operated a business in this Vermont community for many years. And I think as we spun out of Mamava into our own business separate from the studio, I have so much empathy for what you had to manage with those businesses that went beyond just the client work and the hard design work to, frankly, the human side of what it is to be an employer. And so I'm wondering if you have wisdom to impart in that area to other entrepreneurs, what you've learned over the years and how you strike that balance.
I've had a fairly simplistic way of looking at it. I get whether it's back to the farm or not, or just the grateful childhood I had with my mom and dad and family. I've just, a lot of it seems pretty common sense. You can sort of tie yourself in knots with a lot of things because things get complicated and everything you're trying to balance. But honestly, it's like, don't ask anybody to do anything that you wouldn't do yourself. be nice, do your homework, be informed. A lot of it's pretty common sense. And I think sometimes people get a little wrapped up in making things more complex than they need to be. So I would just say, try to understand simply what it is to be a good person. Have a level of integrity. Don't ask people to do things you wouldn't do yourself. And not that I haven't made my fair share of mistakes of just, stretching too far or not realizing, that just because I might be fixated on just obsessively wanting to solve a problem. That doesn't mean everybody is as obsessed as I am.
Yeah, I think I've learned about the good, from the good and the bad, you know, from you as an entrepreneur and how hard it was beyond just the employee management side. Just keeping that balance is a challenge. So we talked at the top of the show a little bit about how we incubated Mama Va at the design studio where Christine and I were working. And it was, I think, like 5 years from the inception of the concept to a prototype that we put in our local airport, and then another few years after that that we actually launched and spun the business out. Can you tell us about the process of inviting employees to develop their own ideas in-house and using those resources of the studio and how that came about?
Well, I think the bodacious optimism dimension has a lot to do with how that unfolded. And the beauty of entrepreneurial naivete. Just a lot of what is often built, and certainly what was built with JDK and even Solidarity and with Mama Va, there's a degree of naivete that I think is healthy of just not necessarily acknowledging or knowing what you can't do. But what that creates is things like, you know, with Solidarity as an example, and what was born earlier of JDK, like having a skate ramp in the basement, like, you can do that. There's no rule that says you can't do that just because a design studio has never done that before. Could you have a gallery? Well, yes, you could. Could you have a nonprofit silkscreen studio because you want to make art as computers are rising and you want to maintain getting your hands dirty? It's like, yes, you can do that. The birthplace of Mama Va and that incubation and how that happened, as I mentioned, we had built a vertical idea. So we had all disciplines going. And again, the point you made earlier, Sasha, about cultural timing, nothing like this really existed before. There were ad agencies that were basically chasing media money, and they weren't even hyper interested in creative. They were, but the business they were really in was managing media. And that's all changed now and completely gone. But at that time, design studios were very, you know, identity-based and pretty bound by a certain set of principles that would create design programs that were brilliant and great, but they didn't tend to blur those things together. And we created this kind of beautiful collision of things where we were so interested in product and we were working with companies where we were engaged with all the disciplines, you know, working with engineers and product designers as well as marketing and brand and sales. And so we were in the thick of it with people like Microsoft and Burton and Nike and Lululemon, and like in the heart of it, we weren't just touching the communications part. And so we built this vertical that we had all those disciplines. So after doing that for about 20 years and doing it very successfully with a number of people all over the world and helping to grow their businesses, this is where the naivete comes in. It's like, well, we should be able to create our own brands. Why don't we create a skate brand? Why don't we do that? And so I kind of had dreamed up this idea of like, wow, what if half of our business was our own brands and half of it was consultative because we want to keep learning and we love working with all these other brands. So that was the orientation is like, well, we have industrial designers, we have brand building, we have writing, at one point I think there were 20 people doing color and trend for all the footwear work we were doing. So that was the catalyst, was thinking like, okay, what if we had control of the creative and the product and the things we were interested in doing? So we basically just opened up the whole idea to the culture and said, why don't we all just talk about what it is we might want to create? We actually had, you probably remember, Chris DeBica wanted to start a church. Was one of the brands. He was like, you know, we should start a church. That was just one. It was wide open, and it was just allowing the entire culture to be like, what would you create if we could create something? What would we create? It could take a lot of different forms. We were just going on intuition, but based on the fact we had built this thing that we believed could create ideas that would be meaningful in the world, and that's where it began.
And it did. And I think there was also something to all of the work we were doing, some of it which was thrown away or never saw the light of day for other brands.
There's
this idea,
missed opportunities.
What if we could control it all? So it's not just that we had the infrastructure to create these ideas or bring them to life, but it was also that we wanted to manage it soup to nuts. And I remember, you know, as we were talking about
and
this in the early days. And have creative control, because we'd see something, well, it was a great idea that never manifested, or it was a great idea that got taken and got manifested poorly. But we were talking to some of our clients in those early days of incubating our own businesses, and there was a lot of like, good luck with that. Knowing, I guess, again, that naivete, you know, some of the hurdles that we were going to, you know,
that was the big moment, actually, that it was like mega naivete. Where, and again, we were completely clear. I mean, we were connected with a lot of factories. We knew how to get product made and done and all those things. I think the big sort of mega naive mistake that I made was we got too many things going. We had five or six things going. They all had great names, great strategy. We developed some product. We actually got some things placed. But the reality and the really big mistake that I made was forgetting that if you actually want to get one of those into the world in a meaning, get an idea into the world in a meaningful way, you need to be 100% focused and committed to that idea. And you couldn't have six of them going at once, at least at the scale that we were. So it eventually got to a point where it was just not possible to maintain all those things, and we had to shift and make a change and focus our energy. Very gratefully, and it actually speaks to the profound insight that you had with Mamava. Mamava is one of the ideas. I mean, a number of them have broken through, but Mamava is the one that really kind of move through that space into like, this is a culturally profound and relevant idea. And you never lost conviction for a moment. Like you kept pursuing it. You know, Christine was there, I was there, all of the, you know, the people that were helping to support along the way, but you never lost that conviction of like, this idea is really important. And you kept informing everyone, this is what's happening with legislature, this is what's going on here. And it was, you were continuing to shape the opportunity in the moment. And to me, that whole experiment, whether there were things that, you know, didn't make it through, the pride of the fact that the one idea that did and continues to be incredibly meaningful in the world is Mamava.
When I look back on that exercise of incubating Mamava and some of the other concepts, is that it's not products that create businesses, it's customers or it's users, right? And that's something that never went away with Mamava. We were seeing over and over again this unmet need. And so almost I reluctantly were like, if no one is going to solve this problem, and honestly, we probably incubated it for like 8 years, you know, if no one's going to solve this problem, we have to fully commit to it. So it must have been very difficult, you know, when you saw a successful project or if a project was on the horizon to actually lead to losing collaborators and contributors. So at going from an employee to spinning out Mamava, and luckily you are very close to the business and continue to be on the board and be a huge advisor to us. I remember that time of sort of like finally leaving the nest. Again, nest is a metaphor that comes up a lot in general at Mamava, but as being really difficult. But if you want to go back and think about kind of those decisions when you were incubating, eventually you were probably going to lose people if you were successful.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I mean, that's part of, I think, you know, learning and growing overall. I remember when we first started the studio and had built, you know, an incredible culture. And honestly, we were all kids. It was a crazy, wild learning cultural thing. And I remember there was so much that went on, the level of learning and the things we were doing and the intensity of the work and everything. And when people would move on, it was really hard-hitting, and it would be such an incredible loss or feel like, oh my God, the loss and betrayal or what, after so much time together. And now you look, and certainly looking back on, you realize that that's not looking at it through the right lens. And over time, and actually at the point that you and Christine moved on to take my, it was a moment of pride. Everything is in motion. Everything is alive and changing. And it was the moment that you needed and Mamava needed, and it deserved to be supported and celebrated, really. So, and it just wasn't scary at all to me. It was, I was really more of a celebratory moment. And that's kind of where I've come to, just in general, just the realization, like, nothing stops changing. Everybody's lives are in motion. We just have these beautiful moments where intersections happen. I think one of the biggest lessons that I've learned, and also that I think people should hopefully carry with them, is when these moments of intersection happen, where the conditions have been created, where it's just right, the conviction is right, the motivation is right, everyone is just converging, and it's partners, it's not just internally, it's like it's partners. We've had many moments where the intersection of the right motivation, people, timing, culture, it's so powerful and just so awe-inspiring. And it's not to deflate that, but it's just to realize how glorious that moment is, and it will change. And you just have to recognize. So when you're in it, love it, like really love it. And it won't be anybody's fault that it changes. It's just inevitable. It will shift. Culture will start to change. And so that way it helps you, when something does change shape, it's less negatively impactful. It's more like, if you keep your wits about you, it's going to change. So really love the moment when it's all right, when it's all intersecting. And it won't change to be necessarily worse. It's just going to be different. Something will be different. So make that different amazing. Whatever the different is.
Make that different amazing. I like it. So the podcast is called The Bodacious Optimist. What are you bodaciously optimistic about?
Multidiscipline creativity. I think there's an awakening going on right now. People who are doing relevant idea growing in the world, I think, have really embraced multidiscipline interaction, and it is far beyond collaboration and just playing well together. It is about third mindness. It's about creating the space and way of working where you enter another level due to empathy for the other disciplines and informed understanding of them, and creating the space and way of working. I see that growing, and I'm very optimistic about that. I think there's more and more people thinking that way and setting up what they're doing to engage that way. And that engagement also, of course, includes the audience itself. So that's one thing I'm really optimistic about. I think a lot of the barriers are coming down, and it's come in with a new generation of thinkers and creators that are unafraid to blur the boundaries of discipline.
Well, Michael Jagger, thank you for deciding to farm back here in Vermont, and for joining us on the podcast, and for being my friend and mentor. You can find Michael's work with his colleagues at solidarityofunbridledlabor.com. And I can't wait to see what other magic and collaboration we can do with each other in the future. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Bodacious Optimist. You can support the show by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. To learn more about Mamava's work making the world a more inclusive place for breastfeeding, visit mamava.com. And remember, we each have different gifts for the revolution.